You are now listening to WBPPR, Big Pretty Public Radio. The following program has been brought to you by JustTheTip.com, a for-profit website providing alternative safe sex advice. Visit JustTheTip.com and find out why they call them old wives' tales and not young mother's tales. And now, an evening with the authors. And I am your host, Dana Glass. Hello and welcome, loyal listeners. I am your host, Dana Glass, and this is an evening with the authors. I am alone at the microphone on this edition after my short-lived co-host, Wolf the Crab Turkington, has moved on to other career opportunities. Otherwise, I could say he has checked himself into a drug rehabilitation center. And I am free to say such things because his niece and my producer, Natalie, is not paying attention to what I am saying as she sits in the booth playing Candy Crush or some other mind-numbing game on her cellular telephone, perhaps Angry Birds, or a game where you run down train tracks, jumping and collecting coins. We can all be safe to assume it is not Words with Friends, for she has no close acquaintances that I know of, and I question if she is literate. And as I suspected, she has heard nothing I have said. And here we are, the bed we have made for ourselves, and now we must lie in it. But if I must lie in this bed of depression and soul-crushing incompetence, I can at least find solace snuggling up and embracing fine literature. Ladies and gentlemen, and all of those in between and on either side, I would like to introduce to you our first presenter. Derek Arisman is not an author at all. He is just an ordinary man who publishes a semi-successful blog that expresses his frustrations of living in a country that is becoming more and more hostile toward men like him. Please enjoy, live from the White Rabbit Cabaret in Indianapolis, Indiana, theforgottenman.net, Derek Arisman.
As I write this today, I am fed up. I am exhausted. And I have had enough of defending who I am to a populace that is controlled by the media, thoughts planted in their heads by marketing firms, and opinions nothing more than echoes of what they have been told. I am proud of who I am. I am proud of my brethren who walk with pride, unashamed of who they are. I write this as a call to arms to these proud men and those that share their burden but have yet to declare their pride. I call upon our president, Donald J. Trump, to stand with us. We see he is one of us, even if he has yet to make a public proclamation. I implore you, Mr. President, do not hide who you obviously are. When you stand on pulpit next to the great Russian leader, Vladimir Putin, do you not see a man who is honest with himself and his people? A man who is not ashamed to embrace who and what he is. So, President Trump, I urge you, for the sake of all of your brothers, use your platform, your power. Stand before the nation, the world, and declare yourself that you are a proud, bald man. How long must we be ashamed, ridiculed for what we are? More than 50% of men are affected by androgenetic alopecia, or male pattern baldness. Up to 85% of all men will experience some degree of thinning hair by the time they are 50 years old. We are not the few, we are the majority. Yet still, I cannot relax on a Sunday afternoon to watch the USA Network without being bombarded with commercials telling me there is something wrong with who I am. Gone are the days of Dwight D. Eisenhower, Winston Churchill, and Dick Cheney. They've been replaced by newer, hairier models like Justin Trudeau and Paul Ryan. Men with no redeeming qualities other than the density of keratin that populates their cranium. In the 1960s, Dr. James B. Hamilton studied 21 boys who had undergone castration for 18 years. Not a single one of these young men developed androgenetic alopecia. Therefore, proving the theory that bald men are more masculine and presumably better lovers than their haired counterparts. When I see Jeremy Piven on my television, I want to shit out of my mouth. He was one of our fastest rising stars. The Larry Sanders Show, PCU, These Friends of Mine, or as you might know it, the TV sitcom Ellen. But then came Entourage and the hair plugs. Joe Rogan was one of us, lost his way, and now he's back and welcome with open arms. John Travolta can go to hell or whatever alternative Scientologists believe in. You're not a haired man, John. You're bald! Sure, Sir Sean Connery would wear a wig for a role, but guess what, John? When the job was done, he took off the rug and he walked down the red carpet as God intended. In conclusion, I say to you, my proud brothers, be who you are. Don't listen to the late night commercials. You are the ideal man. Please subscribe to the blog and keep your eyes open for my next entry entitled, It's Because I'm Short, Isn't It? Good night.
Derek Arisman, taking us to the brink of what we thought we could allow on this program, and then somehow turning left into something possibly even more disturbing. We move on now to a reading from The Heavy Anchor in St. Louis, Missouri, from Dr. Victoria Upwelling. She is a renowned marine biologist and fearless explorer of the ocean, where she has absolutely been before. Here she will read from her research diary and will recount the harrowing details of her most recent voyage and describe the dangerous creatures she encountered while under the sea, where she definitely was. Dr. Victoria Upwelling.
Fellow scholars, esteemed colleagues, it is my great honor to be here with you tonight in the spirit of exploration. And discovery. The only be realized through curiosity. And my curiosity for the sea spans as wide as the sea. Yes, the sea. A place I have absolutely been before. Many times. Many, many times. I have definitely been there. And I am eager to report on my findings from my most recent and most harrowing adventure under the sea, where I was 2 weeks ago. Absolutely. And not at a Holiday Inn Express, like my critics would have you believe. I would like to start by emphasizing that I've never even been inside of a Holiday Inn Express. Least of all, the Holiday Inn Express 20 minutes south of the Fort Lauderdale Airport. I have, however, been under the sea. Many times. I was there just 2 weeks ago, despite every attempt by Holiday Inn Express to lure me in by offering rock bottom prices at the height of vacation season. I mean, what are they giving these rooms away? Their last email to me made it quite clear these deals wouldn't last. But not even their 48-hour sale could keep me away from my first love. The sea. And so for 3 days and two nights, I stayed under the sea and encountered a variety of baffling, if not terrifying, things that even the most seasoned marine biologist struggles to comprehend. And any similarities between what I witnessed under the sea and what happens at the Holiday Inn Express 20 minutes south of the Fort Lauderdale Airport is purely coincidental, because I've never been to it. End of story. Now, with that out of the way, I'll share tales from my latest trip. And for the first time to a public audience, I will introduce you to three horrifying fish that I met while I was there. Explorer's Diary, day one. Day one started like the dozens of journeys I'd taken before. I caught the complimentary shuttle from the Fort Lauderdale Airport. It took it 20 minutes south. My vessel was waiting. Upon arrival, I did what I always do. I requested a room away from the boat's ice machine. Here, I encountered the first of three fish. And I apologize that I don't have actual pictures, but as you all know, you cannot put a camera in the water. It will break. I do, however, have this. And it's pretty spot on, right? The first fish was terrifying. Sharp teeth, intimidating stare, and I'm just gonna say it, no customer service skills whatsoever. Like, why would you put this fish in a position where, like, he's gonna make the first impression? This fish's name was Kevin. Kevin was no help. Despite making my reservation weeks in advance, this fish had no record of me or my loyalty club status, which after this many trips, it's gold level, okay? And that entitles me to two free drinks during the manager's happy hour at the adjoining restaurant, Riptide Sports Grill. From this, I am reminded that the sea is loyal to no man, gold status or otherwise. And what's worse, Kevin didn't even check to see if a room was available away from the ice machine. He just said no, and now every 30 minutes I have to hear it. So I give this fish 0 stars, because I don't think he embodies the spirit of the ocean's corporate culture. Explorer Diary, day two. After a rough night of sleep that was constantly interrupted by falling ice, thank you, Kevin, I rose early to begin the day's research. The in-room curry was stocked with decaf, and this would only be the first horror of the day. So I groggily slipped on my wetsuit, snorkel, flippers, and other accessories that legitimate marine biologists wear, then made my way to Riptide Sports Grill, which plays host to the vessel's free continental breakfast until 9:30 when they open to the public for lunch. It was here I encountered the second fish, and I apologize for not having photos, but this rendering, it's pretty close. Taxonomists refer to this fish as the bacon fish. As in, I watched helplessly as this fish took the entire tray of bacon back to its table, where no one else was seated. That's him. Terrifying, sharp teeth, intimidating stare, and just a complete disregard for all other diners who may have wanted to have a piece of bacon while they waited in line for the waffle maker. I was unable to control my feelings on the matter, so I loudly engaged the dining room with a joke. Hey, what kind of fish takes all the bacon? A selfish. Kevin, always one to ruin something, asked me to keep my voice down. I mouthed at him, but the bacon. And he just brought his finger up to his little fish lips as if to shush me. The bacon was never replenished. Like, what does he even do here? Explorer's Diary, Day 3. On the final day of my journey, I'm exhausted and hungry. I'm just over these fish. What was supposed to be a chance for me to unplug and relax has been a nightmare at every turn. But the worst of my journey was still ahead of me, and its name was Manager Fish. This is pretty much Manager Fish, except he had on a tie. Yes, he was the third and final hell creature outside my door. He was rapping loudly and demanding I answer at once. And before I could even get my goggles on, Manager Fish just keys into my room, and who is with him? Oh, it's Kevin. Yeah. Manager Fish is terrified. Sharp teeth, intimidating stare, and the ability to downgrade my loyalty club points like that. This fish could be my best friend or my worst nightmare, and he chose the latter. Is there some sort of problem, I asked, already making a list of my own grievances to share with Manager Fish about the spotty Wi-Fi, the subpar breakfast, oh, and the extra pillow that I kept requesting all night but never got. Kevin? What does he even do here? There is a problem, answered Manager Fish. A big one, added Kevin in his shitty little fish voice. Did you spend some time at our pool last night, Ms. Upwelling? Dr. Upwelling. And no, I was doing marine biology last night, and I could not take advantage of any of this vessel's amenities. Well, then how do you explain this, Manager Fish asked, handing me an iPad with what appeared to be security footage from the night before. I don't know what this is, I balked, handing the iPad back. You shit in our pool, snapped Kevin. God, I hate him so much. Impossible, I shouted. Why would I go near your pool when I don't even know how to swim? But when it's the marine biologist against the fish will always win. Even bacon fish turned against me. He ratted me out for sneaking extra free drinks at the manager's happy hour at Riptides. That's rich, bacon fish. This whole trip was a big mistake. So tonight, it pains me to announce to you that this was my final journey under the sea. For it will banish you from its Fort Lauderdale location, just 20 minutes south of the airport. Like, you were never even in its loyalty club. And the cost is just too great. $129 a night plus local taxes sounded good to me to chase my dreams. But the $2,461.83 it cost to train, sanitize, and refill one stupid pool that nobody was even using has brought me to shore for good. I leave you with this. I have proven in my career, you don't need to go to school to be called doctor. You don't need to know how to swim to be a marine biologist. You only need to know that the world is full of possibilities. Possibilities that can only be realized through curiosity. And my curiosity spans as wide quiet as the sea, where I definitely was and where I've definitely been before. Thank you.
I never want to be the one to question the integrity of an author, but I think there is certainly something fishy about that woman's story. Excuse me. Okay. Our next author comes to us once again from the White Rabbit Cabaret in Indianapolis, Indiana. She is a retired librarian. During her 35-year career at the Indianapolis Public Library, she curated many of the library's romance novels. After retiring, she chose to elevate the genre by writing dinosaur erotica. Her first book, Sexy Time with Stegosaurus, was a New York Times bestseller. Now we will hear her read from her second novel, The Big Bang. Please enjoy Shirley Wilkins.
Olivia, who was not a virgin, had been sitting in her Jeep for several minutes. She was trying to delay going into Terre Haute's most popular bar, Tyrannosaurus Rex. She didn't feel quite ready for her date, mostly because this was the first time she had ever gone out with a dinosaur. While interspecies relationships had been at first frowned upon, things had progressed. Dinosaurs had fought tooth and nail, quite literally, for civil rights and liberties. They had most recently won the right to carry guns. And most of the dinos in town got their guns from Mansfield, a Tyrannosaurus and small arms dealer. Olivia reached down to her thigh and checked that her own gun was safely stowed in its holster. You could never be too careful when it came to velociraptors. It was mating season after all, which is why she was at the Tyrannosaurus Rex in the first place. She was going to meet Nigel. He was a raptor she had met on the Big Bang, the dating app for both humans and dinosaurs. They had agreed to meet after learning they both enjoyed double IPAs and thought Jurassic Park: The Lost World had the weakest character development of the entire franchise. Olivia sighed, touched up her lipstick in the rearview mirror, and went inside. The usual suspects were there. Women with eyeliner thicker than their thighs, Suds, the town drunk, and the herd of trihorns whose giant Fabio-sized dongs had earned them the nickname Triceracocks. Hey, gorgeous, Suds sputtered at Olivia. Still sure you don't want to give this another go? He gestured toward his crotch, nearly falling over backwards in the process. Olivia shook her head. She and Suds had dated for a while, before she learned his penis was alternative huge. Suds, balance regained, blew Olivia a kiss. She rolled her eyes. What is this, the flirtatious period? She pushed past him, spotting a lone velociraptor near the corner, lamp-like eyes trained on her like she was prey. Or a mate. Or both. You must be Olivia, the raptor said, extending a claw as means of a handshake. I'm Nigel. I thought as much, Olivia replied, sliding into the booth. Thanks for meeting me here. It was no trouble at all, Nigel said, claws wrapped around a pint glass. I am more than delighted to meet at your most favorited canteen, Corbantic even. Like all dinosaurs, Nigel's accent was proper, his wording precise. No one quite knew the science behind the dinos' choice of words, but their extensive, inherent vocabulary meant that every human was now issued a thesaurus at birth. Olivia pointed to Nigel's drink. What you got there?
Triceratops, he said. Decidedly recommended.
After her glass appeared, Nigel and Olivia spent nearly 3 hours talking. She told him about her childhood, her hopes, her dreams, and even her irrational hatred of automatic faucets.
I grew up in rural Indiana. I have to be intolerant of something.
In response, Olivia learned that Nigel had had 2 serious relationships in the past, both with other theropods. Both of those relationships had eventually ended because of Nigel's reptile dysfunction.
I'm quite compunctious about the situation, but right now I find myself enraptured by your winsomeness and pulchritude.
He paused, curious, sniffing at her. Then he turned his head upward and let out the briefest, most sensual of mating calls. Olivia blushed. Her tender flesh tickled with desire. She imagined going home with Nigel and feeling the kiss of his sharp claws as they slid her bra straps off and exposed her naked, heaving breasts. His tongue, hot and rough, like sandpaper that's been microwaved, would lick her goose-fleshed skin. Olivia had never been attracted to a dinosaur before, but she had to respect Nigel. He was interested in nuzzling her nether regions and not tearing her to bits. Nigel seemed to read her thoughts.
I'm not really a raptor. I'm a plesiosaur.
Olivia smiled and downed the rest of her drink. She was going to fuck this dinosaur.
There we have Shirley Wilkins with her heartwarming, steamy tale, proving once again that love knows no boundaries, time and space have no impact on the sexual chemistry of one creature to another. And now finally, we stay within the White Rabbit Cabaret in Indianapolis, Indiana, and we hear from Reginald Archibald Gladstone III. He is the self-proclaimed world's foremost maestro of murder. His many fervent fans have demanded the return of his most popular detective, Inspector Jerry Gerard. Mr. Gladstone is not one to disappoint, especially if it means he can sell a few more books. Though some critics have called his new book a blatant ripoff, he assures us that it is completely different than the movie that came out the same year with a similar name. Murder at the Oriental Express takes Inspector Gerard out of the affluence and into various dens of inequity that the common man often finds himself. He will now share with us his marvel of mayhem, Reginald Archibald Gladstone III.
Several years ago, I appeared on this program to promote my book entitled, Was It the Butler? Since then, my other novels can't seem to stay on the shelves. Perhaps you've heard of my other titles, Death by Edwardian Hospitality. And of course, the New York Times bestseller, The Killer is a Made Man. Perhaps you're familiar with Red Stains on a White Glove, or the thrilling espionage thriller that was so very thrilling, Who Buttles the Butler? Continuing with the same sleuth, Inspector Jerry Gerard, I am pleased to present to you tonight, Murder at the Oriental Express. To those critics who say I am a flim-flammer for composing a murder mystery novel with commonalities with that of a famous murder mystery film, I say, twaddle, bosh, and claptrap. Though I am able to see deep into the psyche of a crook who partakes in the practice of hugger-muggery, I am no commonplace mountebank. I shall call your attention to the realm of farce. It is not uncommon for two completely different comedians to compose the same jest. Practitioners of amusement have a term for this: parallel thinking. So, to those fiendish critics, and you know who you are, I say to the parallel thinking! And why should it not surprise anyone that a mind such as mine might think up a very same idea as one of the greatest murder mystery authors of all time, Agatha Christie. Yes, he created some of the greatest and best-known sleuths in all of literature. His Hercule Poirot, his mysterious Mr. Quinn, and of course his ironically female detective, Miss Jane Marple. My brilliance at deception can be rivaled only by him. Take, for example, the clever way he used a feminine pseudonym as a way to lull the reader into a false sense of security so that they might expect a simple story about lovers or some such drivel. Agatha Christie, indeed. What clever duplicity. Now then, enough bobbery. Let's get on with the excerpts that my publishers have selected for me to read to you. I would like to note here that I have been instructed to refrain from imitating the likeness of accents and foreign voices in my readings. Apparently now it's a whole thing. My first edition of Murder at the Orient Express was written phonetically, much as the style of other great authors, such as Mark Twain and Samuel Clemens. Those were two brilliant men who would not be appreciated by today's critics and would certainly be silenced by their publishers. The first edition has been removed from shelves and replaced with a softer, more sensitive second edition from which I shall read tonight. Chapter 1, Die In or Carry On Out. For some, Chinese takeout is simply a way of life in the dark and dreary pavemented landscapes of Middle America. To wealthy eccentrics living in the country, it's a novelty. Mr. Worthington's son's son, Sonny, thought it amusingly gauche to leave the countryside and dine at the Oriental Express, a Chinese eatery located inside a shopping mall. But this time would be his last. Mr. Irving Worthington's son called for a favor of Inspector Jerry Gerard. Inspector, I have a reason to believe that my son, yes, Sonny Worthington's son, is in danger. Please, Inspector, accompany him to the Oriental Express so that I may know he is in good hands. Of course, assured the brilliant detective. I'll keep an eye on your son, Sonny Irvington Worthington's son. Chapter 4, Unfortunate Cookie. There it was. The Oriental Express, ominously located next to the Petco. This is where you like to dine, Sonny? Inquired the reluctant inspector. Oh, yes, I especially enjoy the General Tso's chicken, answered Sonny. They stood at the back of the line, a line of 12 diners, each ordering something by pointing to an illuminated picture above the cash register. I can see the amusement in all this, reflected the inspector. Curious to see which of the 12 zodiac animals he was born under, Inspector Gerard put all his attention on a paper placemat. There was a scream. The inspector looked up. In an instant, Irving Worthington's son, Sonny, was dead on the floor. 12 chopsticks protruding from his back. The local mall authorities were alerted, and Mike, the security guard, rode up on a motorized two-wheeled vehicle, which was clearly the cause of his obesity. I am Inspector Jerry Gerard, announced the investigative genius, and I deduce that a murder has taken place. For no one is that bad at trying to use chopsticks. Mike, please accompany me as we investigate the scene of the crime. Skipping ahead to chapter 9, Wanton Cruelty. Naturally, Chinese-ese is one of the 17 languages and dialects known by Inspector Gerard. The mall cop was failing miserably at interrogating the young cook, Hu Wei, who, being an Oriental, had no idea what Mike was saying. Are you harboring a fugitive? Speak up. Allow me, interjected the inspector. You there, Hu Wei the cook. Then, in perfect Chinese-ese, the inspector asked, who you hiding? The cook shook his head as if to say, no one. I deduce, shouted the inspector, that the killer or killers is right here. Secure the gate! Mike, the security guard, did as the inspector commanded, successfully locking in the 12 diners, the staff of the Oriental Express, and the two sleuths.
But do you really need to detain all 12 diners, Inspector?
Asked the idiotic, underpaid, lazy watchman. Yes, Mike. Under his breath and to himself, Inspector Gerard spoke in perfect Chinese ease. Something wrong. Chapter 15. Made in China. After using his acumen to cut to the truth of the alibis used by each diner, Inspector Gerard observed some glaring observations that were obvious now that he had observed them. One of the diners was wearing white gloves, but another had an apron tucked in their back pocket. One was polishing a wine glass. Several others were perfectly shown shoes and neatly parted, albeit greasy, hairstyle, and all of them with British accents. Suddenly, realizing that all 12 diners were attempting to eat their food by using only one chopstick, the inspector's eyes lit up brighter than the sign for the number 6 chef special. I've solved the murder, Mike, proclaimed the inspector. In unison, the 12 diners responded, who did it? No, shouted Inspector Gerard, who is completely innocent? Of course, you'll have to buy the book to find out who the real murderer or murderers are. Thank you and good night.
Never a Disappointment, from Reginald Archibald Gladstone III, always keeping you at the edge of your seat until the very end of his tale. That will do it for this edition of An Evening with the Authors. I'd like to thank all of the authors that appeared on this show, and the venues that have housed our live performances. If you would like to see a live edition of An Evening with the Authors, you could follow us on social media and know our schedule. You could find us on Facebook at Fake Authors, or on Instagram at Fake Authors Indie, that is at Fake Authors INDY. You can catch all the episodes of this podcast on iTunes, Podomatic.com, or on the On Tour Records Comedy Network, where you can also find such wonderful programs as Stuart Huff's Obsessive Curiosities. I'd like to thank my producer Natalie for her disinterest in what I've been doing here tonight, but most of all, I'd like to thank you, loyal listeners, for spending an evening with the authors. I'm Dana Glass. Good night.